Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
On the program today, small businesses take on Amazon, the pandemic has more workers looking to change jobs, and what unpredictable work schedules mean for families with babies. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, April 6th. Good to have you with us. Amazon has long had a complicated relationship with small businesses. While its platform helps them reach more customers, Amazon often competes against them by selling its own versions of the same stuff. A new coalition of small business advocacy groups wants lawmakers to step in. The group called Small Business Rising argues that Amazon's size and market power, which have only grown during the pandemic, give the company an unfair advantage. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Let's say you search for a white t-shirt on Amazon. You'll see a bunch of options, some sold by Amazon, some by third parties. You'll also see a bunch of brands, Hanes, Russell Athletic, Fruit of the Loom, and Amazon Essentials brand.
At the core of it is a basic conflict of interest.
That's Stacy Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a research group that advocates for independent businesses and part of Small Business Rising.
Your biggest competitor also owns the infrastructure that you need in order to reach the market. And they're able to glean a lot of information about your business, about your most successful products.
Retailers have been selling their own products alongside other brands since the early 20th century, says Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
Big retailers like Sears, JCPenney's had their own brands, Craftsman, Town Craft, and they pushed their own brands.
That can promote competition and bring down prices, says Ira Reingold, executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates. The risk, he says, is if prices drop too low.
Which may force those businesses to go out of business, and that competition no longer exists.
In a statement, Amazon said its own products complement those sold by third parties, and that its platform helps small businesses generate sales. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There was more good news from the jobs market today. Job openings reached a two-year high of nearly 7.5 million in February, according to the latest from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Hiring also increased, mostly in industries coming back from the pandemic, like hotels and restaurants. The number of people leaving jobs, voluntarily or otherwise, was basically flat. But a new survey from Prudential finds that one in four workers plans to look for a new job soon. That's almost double the usual rate. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on what's going on.
This year, Christian Schmidt took stock of his life.
I don't want to say I was unhappy in California. I wasn't. But I think there's more happiness in a lot of ways right now.
Schmidt's a minister and recently moved to Maryland. He wanted to be closer to family. He was also tired of chasing prestige.
That exists in ministers' lives, too. You know, the lure of the big church.
People have personal reckonings about how work fits into their lives all the time, say after they miss their kid's big soccer game or someone close to them gets sick. Amy Rozeski, a professor at Yale who researches the meaning of work, says the pandemic's put us through a national reckoning.
We know that these jolts make people think hard about what it is they're doing, and this often leads to resets.
During the pandemic, one in five workers changed their line of work entirely, according to the Prudential study. The top reason? Reassessing work-life balance. And Rozeski says this shift has been amplified by people working from home and feeling less connected to their workplaces and their colleagues.
They were suddenly confronted with the work itself, right? You're not getting dressed and traveling into work and seeing your friends and having lunch together.
There's also plain old pent-up demand. companies put hiring on hold, and workers were scared to jump ship. Tom Calkin is a professor of work at MIT.
If they have a job and could continue to work remotely, I think people felt that they were very fortunate and they ought to hold on to what they have. And so we're going to see a bit of a surge.
He says with many jobs staying remote, office workers have more opportunities than ever. That means for employers, well, let the competition over talent begin. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, it was an up day until it wasn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been called the copyright case of the century. For a decade, the software company Oracle has accused Google of stealing code from Oracle's Java programming language in order to build Google's Android system. Google argued that it was fair use. Java is a common programming tool, and many say the claim would be like telling an architect not to use bricks. Yesterday, the Supreme Court agreed, ruling in Google's favor. The decision has implications beyond the tech world. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Somehow, this connects back to rap group 2 Live Crew. I bet you didn't see that coming. Back in the late 80s, 2 Live Crew did this song sampling Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. Oh, 2 Live Crew argued that only some lines were used in order to make a new song. In 1994, the Supreme Court agreed, calling it transformative use. Ever since, some courts have expanded the definition of transformative use, which has made some in Hollywood nervous. Like the Motion Picture Association of America, who filed an amicus brief last year in Google versus Oracle. Christopher Baccafusco teaches at the Cardozo School of Law. He says the Motion Picture Association is worried, not just about new technology,
but also the kinds of creativity that new technology fosters, creative reuses of existing creative content.
They aren't the only ones. The Copyright Alliance, which represents individuals and organizations, issued a statement saying the Supreme Court decision could lead to misinterpretations of the law. Jennifer Jenkins, who teaches law at Duke University, says while transformative use has been expanding,
there are two huge watershed decisions that just came down, like, you know, fresh, that actually didn't put the brakes on transformative use, but put some limits on it.
One of those rulings found that Andy Warhol violated a photographer's copyright by using her image of Prince without credit. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Every weekday morning, David Brancaccio and the team are up oh so early to give you the economic news you need to start your day. The Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. There's been a lot of conversation since President Biden laid out his big infrastructure plan last week about what counts as infrastructure. The plan proposed $25 billion to build and upgrade childcare facilities. And the White House says more is coming in a second bill Biden will propose in the coming weeks. The childcare industry has been ravaged by the pandemic, affecting the people who work in childcare centers, the parents who rely on them, and of course, the babies and toddlers that need care. Myra Jones-Taylor is Chief Policy Officer at 0-3, a nonprofit that aims to improve the lives of infants and toddlers. Dr. Jones-Taylor, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we've heard a lot in the past year about families with school-age children, you know, parents managing remote school and juggling their own jobs, or in many cases, actually leaving the workforce. But what has the pandemic meant for the youngest children babies and toddlers?
You know, we have seen that this has been a tough time for babies and for their families. We know that, you know, what happens in the first years of a child's life is fundamental for everything that happens later. And when families are feeling stressed because of, you know, lack of economic security, that leads to their children's stress. So levels of irritability, not sleeping, regression. So this has really been a tough time for children, babies, and their families.
Access to childcare has also been an issue, not just because of people losing their jobs, but because many childcare providers have shut down. How has that affected child development and family security?
Right. Well, you know, so for one, we think about childcare providers are a major engine of economic security. And that means if they close, then the families who rely on them cannot go to work because they can't send their children to a safe environment. And what happens to children is that's a huge disruption. If they've been used to going to see their peers and, you know, beloved caregivers, and that disruption happens, it's very destabilizing for them at a critical time in children's development.
You and I met actually earlier this year, virtually, of course, in a conversation that the Federal Reserve had about racism in the economy. And one thing you said that really struck me was that one way to address racial inequity is through predictable work hours. Can you talk about how that affects young children and particularly children of color?
You know, it's this one thing that we often think about as an issue of labor, but people often forget about the effect that this has on young children. Low-income families are more likely to have highly unpredictable schedules, which is disruptive for a parent, but it also impedes their ability to plan for things like childcare. It also means instability in your paycheck. If your hours go from 31 week to 15 the next, you can't anticipate that, and that means that you have to make some really tough calls when it comes to paying rent and other expenses. Workers of color are 10 to 20% more likely to experience unpredictable work schedules. And so this is layered on top of all the other inequities that we know are built into our system that families and their children face.
There's a lot for babies and families in the American Rescue Plan that Congress passed in March. The expansion of the child tax credit, more funding for childcare. But I wonder if you feel hopeful that more might be done, given that a lot of the struggle that working parents with young children have been facing all along has been more out in the open because of this pandemic.
You know, it's really a shame to think that people don't think about the challenges that so many other families face until it happens to them. I think we have seen people have an awakening to the challenges that so many families have faced pre-pandemic. And it is really exciting to think that children's needs are front and center of these issues. So the child tax credit is a game changer. It is long overdue. We're happy to see it happen. Of course, what we need to make sure now is that it is made permanent. So we have an opportunity with the major infusion that came through the American Rescue Plan, but now we need to make sure that that stays moving forward, that we don't go back to these days when we had failed systems for children already.
Dr. Myra Jones-Taylor, she's Chief Policy Officer at 0-3. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Coming up,
dumbbells, kettlebells, Olympic weights.
Gotta stay in shape somehow, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 96 points, almost 0.3%, to finish at 33,430. The NASDAQ sank 7 points, less than 0.1%, to end at 13,698. And the S&P 500 dipped nearly 4 points, a tenth of a percent, to land at 4073. We heard from Jasmine about the Supreme Court ruling for Google in that copyright battle with Oracle. Well, Alphabet, Google's parent company, fell 0.4% today. Oracle gained 0.1%. Apple, munching popcorn in the back row, picked up 0.2%. 300,000 tons. That's how much ketchup was sold to food service in 2020, according to the Wall Street Journal. And apparently it wasn't enough. The journal reports that COVID safety rules, plus the popularity of takeout, has led to a ketchup packet shortage. Kraft Heinz rose 0.9%. Conagra Brands, which makes Hunt's, was up 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. There's a big market in parts of Latin America for secondhand goods from the United States. The drivers towing those goods across the U.S.-Mexico border in hopes of selling them in their home countries are known as transmigrantes, and they're a familiar sight on highways in some parts of Texas, often driving pickups with the words "in tow" in big letters across the tailgate. Now, one town in rural West Texas is offering what will be the state's second crossing point for transmigrantes to and from Mexico, looking to cash in on some of that traffic. From Presidio, Texas, Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales reports.
John Ferguson is the mayor of Presidio. He says his city was picked as an additional port for transmigrantes because Mexican officials, among other things, felt the current port in the South Texas city of Los Indios was being inundated with traffic. Since late last month, Presidio has been open to transmigrantes and the loads they carry, household items and junk cars.
They're buying these vehicles in the United States, and they buy also other types of merchandise.
Their trucks are filled to the brim with things like ladders, old bathroom scales, washing machines, and even motorbikes. They bring their goods through Mexico to other countries like Guatemala. Some are dual citizens of Guatemala and the U.S.
And once they purchase all these things, they normally will have like a mid-sized Toyota pickup or something, and towing a second vehicle. And that's how you can always spot them.
It's the kind of stuff transmigrante Bener Lopez was hauling when I spoke with him while he was stopped at a parking lot before the pandemic.
Aquí traemos, cosas que...
He told me everything he has is secondhand. Along with the 1985 Toyota he was hauling, there were a few thousand dollars worth of goods in the bed of the truck. He says he's done this kind of work for a few years and thanks God for the opportunity to provide for his family.
Gracias a Dios que tenemos la oportunidad de viajar y vivir de esta forma.
At one point, there were multiple ports of entries along the southwest for transmigrantes. But beginning in the early 2000s, transmigrantes were only allowed at one port of entry in Los Indios, where transmigrante crossings generally reach a few thousand every month. During the pandemic, those numbers dropped but are now on the rebound, says Jared Hakama, the Los Indios city administrator.
There are times that there's a lot, there's times that there's very few, but they're all crossing, you know, throughout the year.
And that potentially means a lot of traffic for Presidio, the city of about 5,000. Mayor Ferguson says he's concerned about how transmigrante traffic could impact daily life and the city's only major highway, U.S. 67.
It's a two-lane hilly road and not many passing lanes and, you know, just lots of places where people could get in trouble if they don't drive prudently.
But others in Presidio, a city with few industries, see transmigrantes as a potential boon to the local economy. People like Presidio's Isela Nunez. She's also an import-export broker who already works with cross-border goods like machinery, cattle, and vegetables.
There's going to be a wide range of opportunities for not only the brokers, but other people.
She says her business is prepared to fill out the required paperwork for transmigrantes and the loads they carry, but is holding off on hiring any new employees because it's too early to know what the demand will be like.
I think at the beginning, it's going to be slow.
Other local businesses in Presidio are ramping up, too. One business built a paid parking lot near the border to accommodate transmigrante trucks. Another is bringing in mobile homes where transmigrantes can stay the night. Mayor Ferguson isn't sure what this might mean for the local economy.
The transmigrante traffic will contribute somewhat to our local tax base through fuel sales, food sales, things of that nature. But we're not pinning our hopes that it's going to be a gold mine for us.
The new crossing just opened in late March, but so far transmigrante traffic is still mostly going through Los Indios. In Presidio, Texas, I'm Carlos Morales for Marketplace.
We'll get a read on inflation later this week when the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out its monthly producer price index. There's kind of a quaint term for how economists measure inflation. They look at a so-called basket of goods and how the prices of the goods in that basket change over time. Of course, the pandemic has upended how people live and work and spend money all over the globe. In the UK, statisticians are rethinking how they measure economic health. From London, the BBC's Victoria Craig has that story.
Are you guys ready to do this? No. All right.
Like millions of other people, I picked up a new exercise habit during the pandemic. The only problem is I was pretty late to the game. When I realized a month ago I wanted to start pumping some iron, the equipment I needed was sold out almost everywhere I looked.
Dumbbells, kettlebells, Olympic weights, they just absolutely took off. Home sales went from possibly 10% of our total sales to being 100% of our total sales.
That's Neil Jordan, founder of Jordan Fitness, a global gym equipment supplier.
We have multiple containers arriving to the headquarters in the UK every day, and they're all pre-sold. It was incredible. We're generally buying 5-6 months in advance.
A shortage of exercise equipment is just one example of the sizable shifts in consumer behavior due to pandemic lockdowns. Rather than spending cash on gym memberships, many people set up their own home gyms. They ditch the dress clothes and nights out on the town in favor of sweatpants and meal kit deliveries. But even as countries ease out of lockdown, economists like Mike Hardy at Britain's Office for National Statistics think some spending shifts will linger.
We use a range of expenditure data to build up a picture of essentially what UK consumers are spending their money on.
Like the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the US, Britain's ONS uses a so-called shopping basket to measure changes in consumer prices or inflation. Inside are 700 goods people are most likely to buy in a given week, and the contents are updated annually. So this year, out are commercial carpeting, ground coffee, and white chocolate, and in are smart home devices, hand sanitizer, and yes, free weights.
Yeah, so our thinking was that there'll be a permanent change in the way that we work. Many people will be working from home, but, you know, for example, face masks, hopefully when we're all vaccinated, they may not be mandatory to wear in shops moving forward.
An item's longevity is the most important quality when determining what to add or subtract from the basket each year. But updating the very specific contents isn't a quick or simple process, as Hardy explained.
We brainstorm a list of items and then we get our hands on expenditure data for those items. So it takes about 6 months in all to do this piece of work, so fairly substantial.
So if what governments use to calculate inflation has changed substantially because of the pandemic, what other economic indicators should get a makeover? Mike Haynes, professor of international political economics at the University of Wolverhampton, has one idea.
The standard way of measuring the health of an economy, basically since the Second World War, has been to look at gross domestic product or national output. And there's always been criticisms of that.
Some of which is that this measure, GDP, doesn't include things like unpaid domestic work, but it does count full hospitals as a benefit because of the care services we all pay for.
We are working at home. We're not commuting. If we're not commuting, then technically output is going to fall. But maybe not commuting is a good thing, and therefore we need to measure it more positively.
Similarly, if we're working from home more often, maybe we're not frequenting the gym as much. But as millions of us have discovered, that doesn't mean we're not keeping fit or taking money out of the economy.
You know what it looks like. We're going to do it all on the right
Jordan
leg.
Fitness owner Neil Jordan says he expects he'll still supply public gyms with equipment, but a bigger portion of his business than before will go to those of us working out at home post-pandemic. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, which comes to us via Fast Company. A lot of us are all too acquainted with Zoom fatigue by now, but a new survey suggests all this video conferencing could actually be dangerous. Root Insurance found that more than half of people who had driven a vehicle soon after a video call reported having trouble concentrating on the road. Interestingly, younger drivers said they had more difficulty. Researchers say video calls take more concentration than a regular phone call or meeting, and our brains just don't have much left over afterward. Their advice, take a break to recharge before you get behind the wheel, or just don't have as many meetings. Your moment of economic context on this Tuesday. Yesterday, Sabri Benishore previewed what was expected to be a more optimistic forecast from the International Monetary Fund. Well, today, the IMF said the global economy should grow 6% this year, with the U.S. economy projected to grow 6.4%, thanks to all that stimulus spending, and with the not-so-small caveat that a lot hinges on the ongoing battle between the virus and vaccines. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.